typically in the high teens. One or two places still getting up into the low 20s. We will see one or two showers developing, quite sharp showers across some central and eastern parts of England again. But many of us will avoid these entirely and have a dry day. By the end of the afternoon, though, the first of a series of Atlantic weather systems will be arriving across Northern Ireland with wind and rain here for the evening time. And this wet and windy weather will then splash across the whole of the UK as we go through the night, reaching southeast England by first thing on Saturday morning. Very blustery winds, and that cool and blustery wind will be with us right the way through the weekend. It'll carry a whole series of showers across the country. Nobody immune. We're all going to see some rain through this weekend. Slow moving showers across the northern half of the UK, where the winds will be lighter. Further south, though, the winds will be stronger, but the showers will move through quicker, so perhaps a better chance of seeing some sunshine. But despite some sunshine through this weekend, for all of us it will feel distinctly chilly, I'm afraid, with temperatures stuck in the low to mid teens at best. And that's the forecast.
Thanks very much, John. Now we continue our readings from Alexandria by Peter Stothard. In the new year of 2011, the author travels to Alexandria to finally write his book on Cleopatra, but on the night of his arrival, a bomb is detonated outside a Coptic church. The atmosphere in the city is tense. Socrates, an apparently self-appointed guide, has decided to take him to a carpet shop. The owner is absent, and the battered walls of the store have holes in the plaster, some of them covered by large tapestries depicting landscapes and street scenes. The reader is Kenneth Cranham.
Behind the barred wooden shutters, the rooms of piled cloth were silent. A nervous boy brought us tea, his hand trembling as he set down the tiny cups. I asked after Socrates' mother. It seemed polite to do that. She was, he said, still very unwell. Did he know anything specific about possible suicide attacks? Anything that made him especially anxious for a tourist's safety? He laughed. There will be no suicide attacks. There never have been suicide attacks. New Year was something very different. He paused. It was a car bomb, parked and abandoned, not a crazy man in an exploding waistcoat. Only foreigners blow themselves up. Egyptians prefer to blow up other people. The Christians are after revenge, and soon they will find it. Something very different is happening. I had with me a copy of the Egyptian Gazette with a forensic reconstruction of the officially condemned suicide bomber. We looked at the photo-fit picture. Socrates snorted, propaganda, nothing but propaganda, telling the people what they must believe. He did not identify the propagandist. He never mentioned the president. There was only one carpet that I might have been persuaded to buy. A picture of Greek Alexandria as seen from a high point in the harbour, from the lighthouse perhaps, or the palace wall, a mighty city portrayed in tufts and knots, threads of silver, reds and blues. Socrates poked at different parts of the picture and then at the plaster below. His pencil left a soft, dark smudge. "This is Alexandria," he said gratuitously. The boy stood like a stage extra, terrified of dropping his spear. The foreground was packed with brilliant detail, a long facade of columns, windows hung like stages over a wide parade ground promenade. "So think of Cleopatra standing just here, 3 years after the start of her reign, on the highest tower of her palace, looking back at the city that her ancestors had built. She's 21 years old, a queen who almost everyone hates." Socrates stressed the last three words, leaving long spaces between them. He moved his pencil higher off the wall and to the top of the carpet itself, to the repeated lines of background red and brown. The houses of the Egyptian poor that stretched as far as the distant marshes marked by trees. "These people hated her because she was a Greek, a foreigner who pretended to be Egyptian. Well, she pretended well. She learned Egyptian, she built schools and temples, but in some ways, that made it worse. Next, he swung his arm down to the foreground, to the largest of the houses of the rich. The rich Greeks of Alexandria were normally allies of the Ptolemies, their fellow city founders, but Cleopatra had abandoned them. She was now an ally of the Romans. Pompey had restored her father to power. Julius Caesar was doing the same for her. She was a super power puppet. Socrates spun out those last words like a comedian waiting for a laugh. Then he stared hard again at the wall. The boy disappeared behind a curtain into the cavity of rusting iron behind. Cleopatra could not rely even on the Roman soldiers who lived in the houses over here. He moved his pencil to the right, to the streets where the causeway to the lighthouse began. These Gabinians, these mercenaries, had gone native long ago. Like almost everyone else here, they were now on the side of another Ptolemy. The boy who was Cleopatra's brother, an ally of the Egyptian priesthood and an enemy of Rome. Here, he pointed, were the prison cells behind the palace walls. She did not have many prisoners. Most convicts were killed. It was cheaper that way. Sometimes librarians were allowed to cut up prisoners while they were still alive for purposes of science. He paused to make sure that I was listening. There is a lot happening in this picture that most people do not see. Or rather, there is much that they do not yet see. We sat staring at each other. It seemed my responsibility, perhaps my best opportunity, to ask him what he meant, to find out what he was doing, what he and I were supposed to be doing together. But at the moment I was about to speak, the shop owner returned and suggested that surely I must buy the carpet now. Socrates said it was more useful hiding a hole in the wall. I asked if the two men were brothers. Socrates said emphatically that they were not. Whatever his coded purpose, Socrates's description of the background to the Alexandrian War would have been perfectly respectable in Oxford. While his superpower puppet message was none too subtle, and Mahmoud or any supporter of the present regime might easily have taken offence, his analysis of the events in 48 BC was more or less as the story is best now told. Cleopatra was 21 years old when the Alexandrian War began. For 3 years, she had been joint ruler of Egypt, joined in that role by the elder of her two young brothers, whom, by the custom of both pharaohs and Ptolemies, she had also married. Julius Caesar was 52 and had been for barely more than 3 days the sole ruler of the Roman world. At Pharsalus in Greece, he had at last defeated his son-in-law Pompey, the man who had stood vainly for the cause that Rome should not have a sole ruler. Caesar's purpose in coming to Egypt was to kill or capture Pompey, who, despite his defeat, had somehow escaped the battlefield. Two pieces of news greeted him when he arrived in Alexandria. The first, that the ministers of Cleopatra's brother, with help from Roman mercenaries, had already captured and killed Pompey. The second, that this brother was claiming the throne of Egypt as Ptolemy XIII, as a sole ruler whose sister had disappeared. Was she dead or in exile? While Caesar was taking over Ptolemy's palace, Cleopatra proved that she was alive, smuggling herself into the harbour by boat, arriving late in the day and, as has long been portrayed in pictures, books and films, spending the night with the new head of the occupying power. Although Caesar was then married to his third wife, marital conventions had not even a notional application to infidelities of state. Nor was moral outrage the motivation when Ptolemy discovered his sister's presence and learnt of her sleeping partner. The boy king stamped his way into the streets before a turbulent Alexandrian crowd, cried betrayal, and called for armed resistance against his sister and the invader. Caesar never intended an Alexandrian war. He did not expect it. He had arrived victorious, more as a diplomatic judge and debt collector than as a general, with only some 30 ships and 3,000 men, nothing like the forces needed for a war. Suddenly and very visibly, he was an ally of the Greek Queen of Egypt, besieged inside a palace by an army representing almost all her subjects. Caesar sent out orders by sea for food and reinforcement, but neither could be expected soon. He had only Cleopatra for local help. During the day, he fought and directed his men. At night, he dined, conversed in Greek, and slept with Cleopatra. Socrates's quiet comparison between ancient queen and modern president was surprising but not outrageous. To the Alexandrian bureaucracy, the military and priesthood, Cleopatra was a Roman stooge, the daughter of a bigger Roman stooge and in league with a Roman tax collector, extortionist, and maybe even an occupier. To Caesar, she was a necessary ally in his aim of controlling Egypt and using its treasure to pay his legions. Cleopatra did not join in Caesar's ruthless burning of the ships that he could neither man himself nor risk being manned by Ptolemy. The naval fire spread to some books of the Alexandrian library, a large or small number depending on who came to be the storyteller. But in advising on the volatile peoples of Alexandria, the rich, the poor, the Egyptians, the Greeks and the Jews, she would have been a useful agent. She could also tell him much about her siblings and how a brother might as likely murder his sister as marry her. Cleopatra's sister, Arsinoe, escaped to the Egyptian forces and had their commander murdered, replacing him with her own choice. Ptolemy then left to join her. The result was favourable to Caesar. The Egyptian ranks, divided in loyalty between brother and sister, suddenly had also to face two armies of Egypt's neighbours, from Judea and from Pergamon. Caesar's dispatches had produced a prompt response. In March 47, their two forces together marched on Alexandria. The Egyptians prepared but failed to counterattack before Caesar and his allied rescuers combined. In a single battle by the Nile, this Alexandrian war, one of the stranger conflicts of Caesar's career, came to its end. Ptolemy was drowned, and his golden armour dredged from the mud, lest any worshipper of kings as gods should have a doubt about his death. His head and body would have been better proof, but those were gone to the crocodiles and hippos. Cleopatra could safely now remarry under Egyptian rites, this time to the younger brother, known as Ptolemy the 14th, on the rare occasions when he has been noted at all. To the surprise of the victorious Roman forces and the disbelief of the politicians at Rome, she then escorted Caesar on a short cruise down the Nile, partly for rest and recreation, it was said, but also to show the country who its rulers now were. For Caesar, this was a chance to see for the first time what, even 2,000 years ago, were tourist sites. The ancient temples, made of columns 10 times the size of any in Rome or Greece, the towns older than Troy, and the new temples and towns built by the Ptolemies in the style of the old. For Cleopatra, it was an opportunity to show off the miles of cornfields that stretched out on either side, the food which, whether eaten or merely taxed, was life for foreign armies. There was a complete break from Roman politics. There were tame crocodiles to feed and wild ones to avoid, but there were no letters, nothing from Caesar's expectant friends. Caesar had appointed his young ally, Mark Antony, to be his representative in Rome until he returned. There was no fixed time for that return.
Kenneth Cranham was reading from Alexandria, The Last Nights of Cleopatra by Peter Stothart. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Now, what about the other Waters? And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 21st of June. There are warnings of gales in German Bight. The general synopsis at 1800, new lows expected Denmark 1,000 and 150 miles west of Rockall 987 by 1800 Friday. Low southeast Iceland 999 moving away steadily northeastwards. Low South Wales 1009 dissipating. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cira, south at Cira, east 40s. Variable, 4 becoming northerly or northwesterly, 4 or 5 later, except west Viking and east 40s. Occasional rain, moderate, occasionally poor. West 40s, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Variable, 4 becoming southerly or southwesterly, 4 or 5 later. Thundery showers, fog patches. Moderate, occasionally very poor.